You're listening to A Week in Wireless by telecoms.com, the podcast dedicated to everything and anything going on in the telecoms biz. On today's A Week in Wireless, UK telcos demand the government resolves Britain's broken broadband. We find out who's getting off on VR's sexy new trend. And Samsung loses whatever sense of humour it had left and ruins the fun for everyone else. All that and more on today's A Week in Wireless. Do you want to join the argument? Tweet us at telecoms. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of A Week in Wireless, the podcast brought to you by telecoms.com. My name is Tim Skinner, and joining me, as always, Jamie Davies.
Hi there, Tim.
And Scott's disappeared yet again. So we've got Alex Wood from The Memo. How are you doing, Alex?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Oh, pleasure to have you. So before we get going, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and about The Memo and what you guys are doing over there?
So I'm the founder and editor of The Memo. I've been a tech journalist for the last 10 years. Started out in Japan, covering Japanese tech companies and covered tech startups. And through that kind of journey of covering tech startups, inevitably picked up the entrepreneurship bug from being around all these amazing, inspiring entrepreneurs. And that led me on to starting The Memo, my own publication. And what's a little bit different about The Memo is, although we are a tech publication, we're very much for all the people in the world who are not necessarily in tech, but are curious about technology. And they want to understand about how that's impacting their everyday lives, how it affects them, their business, but also their life at home.
Okay.
It's been 18 months and it's been a fantastic journey.
Oh, cool. Oh, nice. I'm glad to hear it. You mentioned just now that that when you're over in Japan, you were doing a lot of tech covering. So why don't you just before we get going, just sort of rack your brains for the coolest thing that you saw in Japan when you were covering the tech sector there. There's got to be some cool stuff going on over there, right?
Definitely cool stuff. I have to say, I was out in Japan, gosh, about 10 years ago now, so pretty much all the things that I saw. So that was very much a budding newbie journalist out there.
And they had HD DVD.
They did, although my first mobile phone in Japan was one of those nice clamshell ones, except you could flip the screen sideways and it was a widescreen sharp TV.
Oh, that is cool.
You pulled the little aerial up and you could watch TV on the train. I thought that was, you know, pretty
cool. At the time, that is
pretty cool. Yeah.
Whatever happened to that?
I think it all got phased out because, you know, the Japanese, they didn't have Android, they didn't have iPhones, and they had their own kind of thing going on. And then as soon as the iPhone came out, it just completely turned the Japanese market upside down. But it's such a shame because I think particularly when we had Vodafone were in Japan for a while, and when they had that kind of collaboration, they were talking about bringing some of the Sharp phones over to the UK, and then unfortunately iPhone came and turned the whole market upside down.
Yes, as it did. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, cool. Well, thanks very much for joining us. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk a bit at the first part of the show today about Broadband World Forum, which Jamie and I were at earlier on this week at time of recording last week for you, listener. And basically over at Broadband World Forum, it sounded like the government got a bit of a kicking from all quarters.
Yeah.
Jay, do you fancy kicking us off?
Well, thanks for, you know, passing the buck there. You know, you wrote the story, but it's you know, it's all right. I wasn't at the keynote theatre at that time, so
I thought you wanted to talk about your Openreach thing.
We can
go in my bit first if you want.
Do you know what? We can go whatever you want, Tim. You know, I know you're feeling a little bit delicate today.
Let's not open that can of worms, Jamie. Okay, fair enough. Okay, well, the buck's been passed back to me. What I'm going to do then, I'll start with a keynote from Government Minister Matt Hancock, who basically told the audience at Broadband World Forum that the government want to see proper 5G start now for the next decade. So he said start now for a decade's time. And so I thought that was
That's nice of them.
Well, it is nice of them.
Yeah,
you know, it's good to know that there's a bit of a priority over in Westminster.
Well, yeah, you know, 10 years, they'll get there eventually.
But that's exactly the point. So, I was sat in this keynote and I was just scratching my head going, what? Really? 10 years?
10 years, yeah. Six years after everyone else, but it's all right.
Well, exactly that. So at the end of the presentation, I quickly kind of raised my hands and was like jumping around in my seat trying to get attention to ask a question, and I was able to. And I said, you said 10 years for 5G? Are we... I mean, I know that you're looking long-term with this presentation, but is that not a little bit too long-term and basically slow? When the rest of the world's doing it in 2018 or 2020 or whatever. And the poor dude kind of... It sounded like he kind of fudged his answer a bit. And it was all very... Well, you know, obviously at some point in the future, we want 5G to be really big deal. And yeah.
And so it just seemed like the government didn't really quite have a clue as to what it planned on doing for this.
I mean, bless them, you know. I mean, ultimately, we know that all politicians are pretty much idiots anyway. So, I mean, you know, you're not particularly surprised that they managed to get themselves in this situation, really. Well,
exactly, yeah. So, actually, I've got his quote here verbatim from his response, which was, "Over the next decade, we see 5G having a role to play in the full rollout of fibre."
Okay.
"This is something to help deliver ubiquitous 5G over the next decade. It's not just about going for full rollout by 2020, but looking much longer term and using these technologies as part of ubiquitous strategy by 2020.
So what's the difference between ubiquitous and full rollout?
It doesn't make any sense what he just said. It didn't make any sense. And then I kind of just played on that. And then so I put the headline, UK Gov targets 2026 for proper 5G. That's good-ish, right?
It's a long time, isn't it? I mean, you know, but we were talking about this with Ian. So so our sister publication, sort of light reading, Ian Morris. The sort of the European and sort of UK sort of editor.
Yeah.
And we were talking about it the other day, and I think we've just got to be completely honest with ourselves. The UK and Europe as a whole, we're not leaders in the technology world.
You know,
are followers. So the fact that we're taking that long to get there, is it a surprise?
Well, exactly. And one of the things that he said in the start of his session was he kind of lamented Britain's sort of fall from what I referred to as digital grace.
Yeah.
Said that we as a nation needed to stop resting on our laurels, which we started doing back in the early 2000s, when we legislated a minimum access speed for all of 28 kilobits per second. With a K, that is, not an M. And he said, and it stayed there after this legislation was set in 2003. So let that be a warning to all of us, quote unquote. While 10 megabits per second may feel like enough for today's needs, it won't be enough for the future. And then some of the dudes questioning him in the Q&A session, basically like, look, in all honesty, Matt, most people would argue that 10 megabits per second isn't enough today in any circumstance, let alone for the future. One dude actually said, how can you call 10 megabits per second super fast broadband? It's not even broadband. So the dude got a bit of a hammering, not just from the audience, but from the Virgin Media CEO, Tom Mockridge, who basically called bullshit on all of this.
Yeah.
And so as the growing consensus that our kind of broadband infrastructure is down the toilet in the UK, Virgin Media CEO basically kind of said, "Let's sort it out, because this is ridiculous." And he cited a lot of things that the UK government is just fudging when it comes to sort of broadband at the moment. What did he quote? He quoted, a muddled policy environment, the vast number of UK bodies confusing matters in the telecom space.
Yeah.
And the broader technology space, I suppose, as well. BT Openreach subsidies through the BD UK broadband initiative, should I say, BD UK initiative, and also Brexit.
Yeah.
Obviously. But beyond all of those, he called out the government on their on the Crosswell Queen Elizabeth line. Did I say Crosswell?
Sorry. Yeah, it's not ideal.
Crossrail Queen Elizabeth line, and said that that Matt Hancock said that they want to have complete ubiquity of Wi-Fi coverage on all trains by 2020, I think. And he said that he looked into this, and the Crossrail didn't have any Wi-Fi capabilities built into it. This brand new infrastructure has apparently, according to Virgin Media, not got any Wi-Fi capabilities. So he said Crossrail has been built and is scheduled for launch in 2 years, but it's been built without the provisions for Wi-Fi. We're building a world-class transport infrastructure, and TfL says it's too busy to think about Wi-Fi. We're getting rhetoric from the government too, and even Matt Hancock said yesterday the government's targeting almost ubiquitous Wi-Fi coverage on trains by 2020, but it's just not happening.
Because you've got a bit of insight into this, haven't you, Alex?
Yeah.
I mean, you've, in a previous life, you've got the inside scoop on what's going on behind closed doors.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a frustrating situation. And in a former life, I had the privilege to be able to come to these behind closed doors number 10 meetings for tech companies in so-called Tech City. Uh-huh. And it's a fascinating thing to watch, because they're meant to be on many, many things, but time and time again, it comes back to broadband. And if you imagine a big, long table in a stuffy old building, and you've got on one side, you've got some really interesting young businesses, some leaders there, and then you've got Openreach, you've got BT itself, you've got TalkTalk, Sky, all of the players, and Virgin Media as well. And it just becomes this giant slagging match where you've got, and I've seen this throughout my career, you've got these kind of figures that are bounded about that the UK has so many people who can get super fast broadband or the average speed is fantastic in London. But actually, when you take a step back from all of this kind of fluff that we get in the press and speak to just genuine businesses, I've heard horror stories. I kid you not, one business. And this is the worst thing, is you hear of these businesses, and we always talk about the government wanting to push technology really hard. I know businesses that have raised millions of dollars of funding, and this is meant to be a success story. We're meant to be excited about this. And I kid you not, they're waiting 18 months to get fiber into their new offices in Shoreditch, in central London. And
that's unbelievable.
Yeah, there's just so many layers of complexity. It sounds very similar to the story you were just saying about Crossrail, because in that particular example, what often happens is it's this mess of public authorities where you've got, on the one hand, obviously the telecoms provider getting the cable in, you've got the actual landlord of the building itself dragging their heels and not allowing them to put it in there, then you've got TfL and the London government arguing about pulling up the pavement, and you've got all these different layers. And that's what I kept hearing in these meetings, was effectively no one was taking responsibility for this, and no one was actually saying, you know what guys, let's put our hands together and actually just get the job done.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that is kind of indicative of where we still are. So not much seems to have changed in the time that it's been since you were sort of privy to those meetings.
Yeah, and I think startups continue to suffer from that. And, you know, if you want to talk about things that can hold us back in terms of economic growth and being a great tech leader, this is just such a basic issue.
Yeah, entirely. I think that's kind of the point of a lot of the keynotes that we saw from the, at least from the UK companies this week, was basically just saying, look, can we sort this out?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of, I think there was a lot of people saying Britain is, you know, this great country, and the only way we're going to maintain that position is by fully embracing and evolving into the digital economy.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was a lot of people that just saying, there was a lot of talk at the show. I mean, it's really frustrating when you go to these keynote sessions and you get these absolutely fantastic senior guys up front and they don't really say anything.
Yeah.
You know, they say, you know, this is the problem. We're taking too long. Yeah.
Yeah, oh well.
Yeah. 20 minutes done, isn't it? Yeah, any questions? You know, and it happens time and time again.
It does, yeah.
I mean, the one thing I did notice, because I was in broadband for day one.
Yep.
And then I went to another conference for the second 2 days.
Yeah, which we'll come on to later.
Yes, we'll come on to afterwards. But the one thing I did notice all the way through was there is a lot of finger pointing.
Yeah.
A lot of people were blaming, but no one was really willing to, like you said, put their hands up and take control of the situation. OpenReach was another one.
Yeah.
I think this is brilliant. Absolutely fantastic. Their CEO literally came out and he just said, Ofcom, another bit of government bashing, said, pull your finger out and start doing some real work.
Yeah.
I mean, this is down to the strategic, let me just get this right. The strategic communications review, which has been going on for about 2 years.
About 200 years, it's
felt
like.
Yeah. I mean, and then sort of the OpenReach guys, they just turned around and said, stop doing this bloody review, you know?
Yeah.
You're taking too long, you're looking too in-depth.
Especially at the moment where the industry is changing so rapidly.
Yeah.
Not just telecoms, but society, the technology that's provided the advancement of society is going so rapidly towards a new generation.
Yeah.
We can't sit still and just try and take stock and take 2 years to do it.
Well, that's
it's going to be 3 years by the time it's finished, isn't it? Or something along those lines.
I mean, that's exactly what Sally said.
Right.
He said, a review was needed, but bloody hell, get on with it.
Yeah.
You know, how long do you need to take to come up with the idea of, we need faster internet.
Dude, go to speedtest.net.
Yeah.
And that's not a sponsorship thing. They haven't asked us to say that. just pull your finger out.
But I mean, the great thing was is that when we wrote it up on the, put it up on the website, and we were saying, like, OpenReach blames Ofcom for dragging its feet. Apparently, our readers didn't like that. So a couple of the comments were, a guy called Chris Conder, him and say, what a ridiculous statement to make. It is not Ofcom messing around, it's OpenReach. They prat around protecting their obsolete copper assets with VDSL and GFast.
Yeah.
So, they're not great.
So, and then, that actually just it does touch on a point that is what's seen OpenReach come under fire so much from the other players, the guys like Sky and Virgin, and not Virgin so much, but Vodafone and TalkTalk, with the what we've talked about before, this Fix Britain's Internet campaign.
Yeah, yeah.
this ridiculously petulant campaign, which I think everyone's lost as a result of.
Yeah, just moany little bitches, really, aren't they? Yeah, it's just literally having a moan.
But the point that they're making there is that BT's relying on this old infrastructure. They're relying on copper to do the job that fibre should be doing.
Yeah.
And Openreach can say all they want about fibre being really difficult to lay, and it is very difficult to lay, but then just get doing it. Just start doing it, and then it'll happen quicker.
I got to be honest, I got a little bit of sympathy, only a tiny little bit, uh-huh, for Openreach, and this was something that came up in the presentation, and he said VDSL was the right technology at the right time. He said, we're going to move on to fibre and we're going to start rolling out, like, every new block of every new housing development of over 30 houses is going to have fibre, yep, fibre to the premises.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's great.
I think a part of that comes down to the fact that there are players doing that anyway. So, like, yep, Hyperoptic and whoever else it is, City Fibre, I think it is, are doing that as well.
But he did turn around and he said, well, consumers are never happy. Mm. It's like, ultimately, we needed to increase, we needed to get better at broadband 2-3 years ago. So we need, and they wanted it done super, super fast. They wanted super fast broadband right now. So we had to use VDSL. You know, if we'd done fibre, it would have been 12 months before we can, you know, before we gave, you know, met the consumer demands.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, yeah,
you know, he is caught in between. I mean, as much as
it is a rock and a hard place,
yeah,
isn't it?
As much
it really
as
is.
We dislike Openreach,
yeah,
it is. You are stuck between a rock and a hard place. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think it comes back to the whole idea of so many different players in this, because you mentioned about their aspirations to put it all into new buildings. Well, I've seen many report that new blocks of apartments in London are still being built without BT lines being connected to them,
yeah,
because the property developers don't want to pay the fee to BT. So once you, yeah, buy a new flat, you move in, and then you've got this hassle of them even connecting them. And so,
well,
completely not joined up.
Well, this is one about a month, maybe 6 weeks ago, I had a bit of a rant on air about my experience trying to switch from BT to Sky, and they tried to charge me £30 for disconnecting my line. I was just like, are you kidding me? Really? You're actually charging me for leaving you?
And then Sky are probably going to charge you for reconnecting.
No. Sky actually said, actually say this specific line to BT, they'll scrap the charge. If they don't drop it, then we'll refund you it.
Okay.
So fair play to them in that sense. That's a pretty decent way of acquiring customers.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think that's pretty much covered all the stuff that happened this week of broadband, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of finger pointing, not a lot of progress.
Yeah.
And
government
a lot of
rhetoric.
Government bashing.
Yeah. Oh, and bashing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Rhetoric from the government and bashing of the government.
Yes, yeah.
By, to be fair, some pretty senior dudes in the industry.
Yeah.
You know, when the CEO of Virgin Media actually basically said, we've got BT's back here, you need to pull your finger out and do some work. That doesn't look good for them. Anyway, we've done enough government bashing. We're going to play some music or something and be back in about 20 seconds. So stick with us. We know you love us here at A Week in Wireless, so why don't you follow us on Twitter? Tweet us using the hashtag AWIW. Let us know what you think, and we'll tell you what we think of you on next week's episode. And we're back. Welcome back to A Week in Wireless. Now we're going to hear a lot more of Alex's voice in this half. I think we, Jay and I, dominated proceedings with our,
yeah,
anecdotes of Broadband World Forum just now. So, right, this bit, we can still talk-ish about the show because Jamie had a bit more fun over in the VR side of things the couple of days ago. So, Jay, why don't you sort of get things going with your account of going to a big virtual reality fest?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was a great. It was a really, really good conference. And I think it was basically the polar opposite of broadband. Like, you went from the broadband theatre, where it was sort of quite, not quiet, but it was quite mellow.
Talking about VDSL and fibre.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't that buzzy. Everyone was just a bit, you know, a bit sat back. But then you went next door into the VR and AR conference, and it was mental. Yeah, it was.
Producer Brad is raving away.
Yeah. But, well, me and Brad, we had a proper bromance over the last 2 days. Literally done nothing but spend all day with each other. He's been behind the camera the entire time. I've been in front of it.
Oh, and Brad's blushing as well.
But the atmosphere in there was mental. Everyone was loving it. And I think, I mean, just so I've got, you know, a few notes that I've taken down here, just like the whole the whole conference as from day one and day two, I mean, I took away that there's great potential in it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of excitement, a lot of excitement. There was quite a few investors bumping around. So there's a load of people trying to you know, throw some cash at it.
Yeah, yeah.
The use cases, they've definitely been outlined now. And this is one thing I know you're going to hate.
Why?
But we're going to bring up Pokemon Go.
In what context?
So Pokemon Go, and this is something that I think is... I hate Pokemon Go, don't get me wrong.
Uh-huh.
But it did open the world up to VR and AR. Now...
Yes, I suppose. But before anyone thinks we're going to say it's augmented reality, it's not augmented reality.
No, it's not. It's not really augmented reality. I mean, they say it is, but it's not. Mm. But it normalised the technology for the mass market.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, all right.
So it opened the door for VR and AR to explode, which is great. I mean, like they said, like the HTC Vive, they were talking, they did a presentation yesterday, and it's only 6 months old. I can't believe that. I mean, when he said it, I was like...
Is it?
It feels like it's 6.5 months old.
Nah.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it's...
But I used it 4 months ago. I didn't realise it was so infantile.
Yeah, yeah.
At that point.
I thought it was like... Damn. I thought it was quite... I thought it'd been around for ages.
Yeah.
Brad, he did say 6.5 months, didn't he? Yeah, yeah. It's definitely 6.5 months.
That's a nod from producer Brad.
Yeah. And it's just mental how far they've come in such a short space of time. But... The one thing I will say is that, you know, let's put it a little bit in perspective. The hardware isn't there yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's still way too expensive. Like, what's the cheapest one? The HTC Vive is $800. I mean, I know that's best in the market and it's premium.
No, but that's before you get the computing power you need, right?
Yep. Then you're adding an extra, grand on top of it when you're looking at, like, the computer power.
Brad calls it hashtag bulky.
Bulky, yeah. Hashtag cult. Mm. And it's not been completely normalised. The content is still limited. They haven't actually, you know, got through to this fully immersive situation at the moment. And let's be honest, we still haven't figured out where VR and AR sits in the industry. It's, you know, there's lots of great ideas, but we haven't nailed it down yet.
Yeah, yeah. Before we move on, I'm just going to sort of recount my experience of walking into VR AR world, having spent 3 days in Broadband World Forum. It kind of felt like being two houses, and in one house you're sat having dinner with some very sophisticated people, and you're talking about very intelligent things, and you're having a nice dinner party, and someone brings out the after eights, and, you know, a little bit of cognac or something. And then you go next door and there's like a proper full-on house party going on.
Yeah.
And everyone's doing like kegs of beer from a handstand.
Yeah, red stripe everywhere.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Beer sambuca.
And, you know, just walk in, it's like, ooms, ooms, ooms. Yeah, I'm having so much fun!
It was great, yeah. It was great. I mean, one thing that I'd like to do now is that as I was wandering around, I did ask a few people.
Mm.
You know, I got a couple of sound bites off people off the floor, and it was literally a case of, I asked them a question, what do you think the biggest disruption, the biggest trend, the biggest its thing for VR will be in sort of 2017? Yeah. So we got a couple of sound bites, which I think Brad is going to very kindly play for us now.
This is Jason from Zerolite. The biggest trend in VR in 2017 is going to be all about quality content. So 2016 saw us get an install base of HMDs. 2017 we have to produce excellent quality content, which is going to keep them engaged with them.
My name is Dr. Joe Twist, and I'm the CEO of UK Interactive Entertainment Trade Network, that represents games and interactive entertainment companies in the UK. I think one of the biggest trends, obviously, game developers have really had a lot of many years of experience of building in three experiences in 3D worlds, and I'm interested to see how the film industry, TV broadcast industry, designs or looks at designing those kinds of immersive experiences. I think AI and non-player characters and interaction with the environment is going to offer some design challenges. So I'm looking forward to AI developing in a particular way that may result in new game genres.
Hi, my name is Paul Farquharson. I'm from Barclaycard. I think one of the biggest trends to emerge in 2017 will be social and voice-activated commerce. Well, that's the likes of Google Home and Amazon Alexa, to be able to make payments with your voice.
Hi, this is Ryan from Meta, all the way from Silicon Valley, the place, not the TV show. And for 2017, I think the big thing is going to be the enablement of dreams coming true for all those people out there who have been waiting for immersive augmented reality. They can finally build all of the things they've been waiting for a device to build on, and that is going to propel AR into the mainstream.
So as it's, yeah, so as you can see, there's still a lot of work to be done. And like I said, it hasn't quite figured out its place in the industry.
Sure.
You know, we heard sort of quite a variety of answers there, whether it's, you know, mass market, the integration with AI, when we're talking about sort of live TV. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different areas which people are sort of trying to address all at the same time. So that it's a bit sporadic. It's a bit... all over the place, and we're just waiting for sort of Moore's law to kick in and the sort of the acceleration of the technology.
Mm. So you've mentioned it hasn't quite found its place in the industry, but there is definitely one industry in which it's absolutely found its place. Alex?
Well, so we've been covering VR throughout the last year, and it's just growing and growing and growing. But if there's one area that definitely is monetizing, it is pornography.
Oh my God. Go on.
So we, our writer Kitty, we call her the Queen of VR at the Memo. She has, she's done a series of interviews with a fantastic lady called Ella Darling. Ella Darling is the co-founder.
And what does she do?
Well, so Ella is a fantastic story in her own right. So she's a porn performer and also a live cam girl. But she's also the founder of VRTube.xxx. And... You should check out our numerous interviews and features with Ella, because
I genuinely thought you were going to say you should check out VRTube.xxx.
I thought you were going to go there. I was going to say not on your work computer.
Not on your work computer. Definitely not safe for work. But I think you know, we've got precedence with this. If you look at history, many of the greatest technologies, whether it's video streaming or online payments as well, they all happened because of pornography. Pornography actually drove technological change on the internet. And I'm just going to put it out there. You can quote me on this. I do think that VR porn might just be the thing that pushes the industry.
The single biggest enabler.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, funnily enough, that didn't come up at the conference yesterday, you know. Would you believe it?
Do you know what? I think the organisers of the event should introduce a track next year, which is just VR porn.
Yeah,
as an industry.
Because we were talking about this beforehand, and you come across quite a bit of porn on the Memo at the moment, haven't you? So there's
very much from a business perspective.
I was going to say, I'm assuming discussion of porn as opposed to just porn.
Yeah, because you were talking through a number of different apps and sort of applications from VR. I think some of it's quite disturbing.
Yeah, I think if you take a step back from just what we would traditionally think of as pornography, what's even more frightening, I think I might say, is actually the way that people are now adapting this technology. So along with our reports with Ella Darling, we've looked at many people who are looking at actually making holograms of people and then creating virtual porn films. So we are, I kid you not, very close to a point where Kim Kardashian, effectively her body image, can be copied, and then you're going to have like bootlegged, faked versions of porn films with Kim Kardashian. It's an intellectual property nightmare, and it is absolutely fascinating.
Ethically, it is. It's wandering down some pretty dark alleys there as well.
I mean, I had my head in my hands during that bit, because that's some disturbing That is, I'm going to ignore completely what Brad was just doing behind the screen there. That is really, really kind of f***ed up. Yeah. let's mince our words with that.
And it's funny what you're saying about the conference you were at, that there was no mention of this. When I was at MWC earlier this year, there were demonstrations in some of the largest VR porn studios, not at the convention centre, but a nearby hotel lobby. And some of our reporters were treated to trying out, but it was the strangest thing, because they were there in the lobby and they were told, oh, just have a seat there and just pop the headset on, and they've got pornography streaming on there. And do not underestimate the size of this industry over in the States. It is being taken very seriously. It's seen as a premium product. It's seen as potentially the one thing that will save the porn industry from streaming video. It's a big deal.
We should get our colleagues over on the TV content mags to come in and have this discussion with us.
Yeah. I mean, it is mental. I mean, even a couple of weeks ago, there was that the doppelganger.
Yes.
The porn doppelganger, where you can sort of take an image of a Facebook friend and you sort of plug it into this app, and it finds the most similar porn star for you for your evening's entertainment.
Yeah. Your evening's entertainment.
Your evening's entertainment, yeah. Which lovely. Is disturbing.
That is all kinds of creepy. That is so creepy, it's not even possible to put into words.
We've had another story out today that was terrifying, that there's a Russian company. We always hear about image recognition, and we know it's getting better and better, but these guys have got 70% success rate from, let's say you're on the train, you see someone you fancy opposite you, you take a photograph of them, you can come home, and then you can put it onto your computer, and it will actually find them on social media or on dating sites.
I mean, what?
The kind of levels of creepiness, I think, to be honest, I think we're not ready as a society for these kind of changes. It is absolutely terrifying.
Like Jamie said, this is going down a very ethically dark route.
Yeah.
I mean, I read the article you're talking about, and the founder of that organisation did say it doesn't do anything that's not already, or it doesn't look up any information that you haven't already put in the public domain. However, to then be sort of indexed and found so easily by literally anybody,
it's normalising stalking.
It really is normalising.
I mean, this is one thing. And we're going to get back to the government in a little bit right now.
Okay.
Purely because what these technologies are doing, we're going to have to write completely new sets of laws about this as well. I mean, it's going to be an absolute nightmare. I mean, how do you regulate this sort of thing?
How do you legislate for this sort of stuff? Yeah. Well, I mean, that kind of touches upon our doxing discussion from last week.
God,
right?
That was where mental. Do you know what doxing is?
No.
So it's the process of it's like, sort of like cyberbullying, essentially. But if say I have an issue with Tim, not that we ever have an issue, you know, it's fine.
Never.
Yeah. What are you looking at, Brad? basically, say I've got an issue with Tim, I would put his home address online, on Twitter, on Facebook, and encourage people to mess him up. So sign him up to, like, all sorts of, I don't know, junk mail.
It's like mass trolling, basically.
Yeah, get 100 pizzas delivered to my house, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so that's now, you can be prosecuted for doing that. You can, the CPS have brought out new rules that you can be prosecuted and taken to court and taken to jail for 12 months, I think.
Wow.
So they're taking it seriously.
Yeah.
But it just shows, I mean, it's mental what the digital world is doing to us.
Yeah, I mean, on a happier note, connecting all that together on the VR side.
On a happier note, let's get back to porn.
Well, I was going to sidestep away from porn for one second.
We'll just leave it where we had that happy ending and move on.
Way lols. Oh.
I was going to say another example of actually where VR is making money and is really useful. So over the summer, I tried VR therapy. So actually talking to a mental health counsellor using virtual reality. And he is making money. He's charging for this. So let me give you an example of how he's doing it. So he's your classic guy who is seeing city folk who have got some serious phobia. You know, you can develop a fear of flights later in your life or you can't.
I actually did that. That's happened to me.
Yeah. And so he actually uses virtual reality created environments to walk you through that fear, that moment that you're absolutely terrified of. And effectively, if you think about the way that counselling works, you start with talking about the issue, you build up, and normally he would have to actually take you to on a plane and actually talk you through coping strategies.
But
using a VR headset, he can effectively shorten the whole process down. And the whole time he had a biometric sensor on my finger, and he's actually monitoring my body's reaction to the situation he's putting in. I'm terrified of needles and I have to have blood tests and all. So he actually took me into a hospital waiting center. And like, it's amazing because he's just like giving therapy, talking you through this whole thing in real time, and then saying, look, this is how your biometrics gone up and down. But he's charging like 150 quid an hour, but he can fix fear of flights in 3-4 sessions.
Wow.
Like, it's significantly cheaper.
That's really impressive.
And I think don't underestimate these kind of fringe uses. So this is just one guy who heard about a company in Barcelona that are making these VR worlds specially for therapy. And there's a whole community around the world of people who are just making money out of VR already and just realising the application.
I mean, that's the one thing that came up from the show more than anything else, is that the number of use cases that are out there, there's so many. They really are having a look at how to do it. But one really interesting point, which was coming up a little bit, but not really being addressed, is that there's a lot of hype around VR, but are you actually, is it innovation for the sake of innovation? Now, what is the point in investing in VR if current technology can do that job? Yeah. You need to find a use case where your example is a great example there, where current technology cannot do it, and that's the only time
and
you can invest
with,
in VR.
Yeah. Samsung Gear VR. He's not. You don't need Oculus. You don't need HTC Vive to do that kind of thing. Sure. Actually, a very cheap consumer headset
pretty
is
perfect. Rudimentary
yeah,
VR.
It's,
do you know, the one thing that scares me a little bit about VR is that you see a lot of companies getting involved in it at the moment, and a lot of people trying playing around with videos and all that sort of thing. We still haven't seen anything go viral, really, either. There's not been anything to set the world on fire. Mm. But my worry is that people won't spend enough on it, and you'll get these half-assed experiences, and all of a sudden I put on a headset and they haven't pushed enough cash, they haven't thrown enough investment in it to make it this brilliant experience. Mm. And all of a sudden it's a bit half-assed, and I'm like, well, give a shit. I'm not gonna do it again.
I completely agree with you. I actually had a really interesting chat with the guys behind David Attenborough's productions
at Christmas
last year.
Okay.
And he was actually saying that they do not want to repeat the same mistakes of 3D for that very same reason.
Yeah.
That they didn't actually think about the narrative. They didn't think actually I'm making a different product. So I had a look at the recent one where David Attenborough, you can actually go in VR with him and he's actually bobbing about in the water. And you actually go for a swim with David Attenborough. And that as an experience, that's something you can't get in film, because you're turning your head and you're looking at everything and he's talking you through and you're experiencing his exploration. And they seem to be, I have a lot of hope for VR, because I think they don't want to make those mistakes again.
Yeah,
absolutely. In fact, actually, producer Brad was getting very animated because he says that he did it and he is very animated about how much he enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But that's the worrying thing. Like Attenborough's crew, you can imagine they always go big. They'll always go big because you can guarantee anything that Attenborough does, it's gonna have a payoff. But it's other people, sort of like I don't know. I say Coca-Cola. I don't know why I say Coca-Cola, but
let's run with it.
Yeah, let's go with it for the moment. I haven't seen them doing anything in VR. But what if they have some sort of little innovation team? They're gonna go have a look at VR. See what you can do. And all of a sudden, they just come up with this little Mickey Mouse idea because they haven't thrown enough cash in it, A brand the size of Coca-Cola, they have this huge potential to normalize VR purely because of their outreach and their brand credibility. So they could make the difference in the industry, but unless they go big, heavy investments, it's going to ruin it.
Well, you mentioned that, actually. That takes me back to an event that Thomson Reuters, I think it was, hosted over in Canary Wharf, probably about 4 or 5 months ago. And Scott and I both went to this event, and they had the lead digital dude for The Guardian basically just talking on this panel about the VR experience that they did, which was, it's called 6x9 or something like that, I think it
was. The one where you're in a cell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which was meant to, recreate the experience of being in solitary confinement in prison.
Okay.
Now, he said you have to go big on that. On that sort of thing, you have to go big on these projects. You have to have enormous amounts of investment, enormous amounts of energy, and resource that goes into this thing. Otherwise, you, as you touched upon earlier on, you have this sort of half-assed approach to it, and it doesn't pay off. Now, there is also a point that he made as a little aside, which was when you're doing something like a solitary confinement experience, it's so intrinsically harrowing, or it's meant to be such a horrible experience, that you want to accurately represent it and make people experience what people are experiencing, not need to go to therapy afterwards.
Yeah.
So there's a fine line that you've got to tread when you're doing that as well.
Yeah.
We have got something on our list here, which is about the sort of augmented side of things. Alex, I think you call it mixed reality, and that's Meta.
Well, Meta. So that it is VR. It is AR.
AR.
Not mixed. So the Oculus. The HoloLens.
Yes.
That is mixed reality.
Yeah, I would call that mixed.
HoloLens is Microsoft, isn't it?
Yes. I think there's a lot of blurred terms, but I would call HoloLens mixed. That's right, isn't it?
So there's this company called Meta, and they've brought out a new product. And Ryan, I'm really sorry, but I cannot remember the name of your product. Me and Brad did interview him, and it was a great interview, so that'll be going up online before too long. So
okay.
We'll make up for it there, Ryan. But at the same time, that was pure AR. And I think it's a little bit behind VR, but the business cases for this are mental. I love it. You know, like, I mean, the advertising world just completely changes. In terms of, can you imagine walking down the street
and you're looking at a billboard and
not even that, you know, or something, so someone pops, like someone walks out of a store and has a conversation with you, virtually someone, or yeah. And then the guy we spoke to, a guy from TFL as well, which was brilliant, and I love this use case. He said, remove all the signs, every street sign in London, get rid of it. And then when you've got these AR glasses on all the time, that's where the signs appear. So you actually have the city, and no, you know, stop here sign,
just
or
some really strange
crossing.
Utopia, just where there's just the city's just deserted.
Well, just people are still going to be
loads
there.
Loads of people sort of bumbling around with these headsets on, but not...
And driverless cars taking you out.
it's so strange. Do you know what? I'm not on board with this.
I think it'd be great. You could actually see a city, and it actually be like a city instead of having, you know... that's one of the things that when you walk around central London, it looks bloody hideous because, you know, health and safety has gone mental. And they've just got signs everywhere. So, yeah, just get rid of them. PC brigades, bugger off.
So just a couple of last bits then before we finish up then. Something back in telco world, we'll keep this very brief. We can't have an episode of A Week in Wireless without mentioning everyone's favourite American CEO, John Legere, who, by the way, didn't take us up on our offer of coming on the show.
So we're still going to pronounce his name incorrectly.
We're still going to call it Legere.
Legere.
Yeah, yeah.
So John Legere.
Yes. Not Ledger.
No. What planet does he think he's on?
Basically, his company has been fined for kind of... That's a cheer from Brad. they've been fined a whopping... Do you like the good "whop" at the start of that word? Whopping. No? Should I just read it?
Carry on.
Yeah, okay. A whopping $48 million for throttling network speeds and false advertising.
Yeah.
And this, I believe, is in relation to their sort of unlimited... data buckets and their very high usage.
That's right.
Sort of terms, and basically really screwing people over if they're using a bit too much data, but they're not appropriately letting them know that they're going to be restricted. So yeah, that happened. Yeah. But Alex, you've got our kind of and finally moment.
Yes, there's been a fantastic story out today. So we've all heard about the Samsung Galaxy Note 7 and its explosive issues.
And we have loved this.
Yeah. It's featured so much.
It's just a gift that just doesn't stop giving.
No, absolutely.
So there's been a really interesting story came out this morning that Grand Theft Auto, some clever folk have modded it so that you can actually use a Note 7 as a weapon in the game. So you can actually pick one up, chuck it and throw it as a bomb at people.
That's amazing.
It's a brilliant bit of creativity. But then, yet again, we're having the old Samsung PR issues. It's something deeply wrong in the PR department
there. They found out they don't have a sense of humour.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, of course, some YouTubers have captured some videos and are sharing it out there. As you do, it's part of life today. Yeah. And they found that Samsung have thrown copyright cases at YouTube and had Google pull the lot of them down.
Come on.
Which is just, it's just not okay, really.
Because that has what made this saga just absolutely... unretrievable for Samsung.
Absolute zero bants. Zero bants.
It's not even dealing with the source of it. This is very meta. You're dealing with someone capturing a video of a thing that's already happened.
Yeah.
And then to kind of throw an extra fan the flames even more. Terrible puns. But the one of the YouTubers involved that we wrote about this morning, we can't confirm this, but he said, you know, I'm just a dude at home. I'm actually suffering with cancer. And YouTube channel was like how I was making money. And Samsung, you're a giant corporation and you're shutting down like one of my only sources of income. Now, we can't confirm this, but if this is true, this couldn't... how much worse can you get this PR situation?
You know...
This is basically, just Samsung stopping a dick.
You know that we talked last week about Yahoo relentlessly shooting itself in the foot.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
This has just gone so far beyond. This is incredible. Just... the guys have just got to chill out a bit. Just realise that this is out of their power now. This is out there. It's completely backfired. Blown up in their face.
Imagine. Next week it's going to be Samsung head of PR kicks baby or something like that.
And on that note, we're going to call it there, I think. Thanks very much indeed for listening to A Week in Wireless. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back same place, same time next week. Actually, John, before we leave, I've got to thank Alex for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been great having you.
Yeah, it's been really fun. Make sure you come back again soon.
Thank you.
And thanks to Jamie.
Thanks, Tim.
And thanks to Brad. Bye, Brad. See you later, gang.
Thanks very much for joining us. This has been A Week in Wireless, the podcast brought to you by telecoms.com, covering everything and anything in the telecoms industry. If you want to join the argument, tweet us at telecoms. Share your thoughts. We'll see you again next week. Same place, same time, same people, but even better.